Well, welcome back to Coast as we get your week underway. Up next, I'll be talking with a psychic medium, a spiritual counselor, who's an expert crime profiler, but he's a psychic. Up next, Robbie Thomas joins me on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you a little bit about our special guest. Robbie Thomas is a psychic medium, spiritual counselor. He helps families and police fight crime, and while bringing solace to those who need it, over many, many years of assisting in many murder missing people's cases, Robbie has been able to give great detail to those devastating crimes or happenings which have led to finding lost people, arrests being made in murder cases, bringing closure to families who desperately need it. Robbie works closely with families in conjunction with law enforcement, helping to resolve some of the toughest cases indeed. He is a psychic profiler. His book is called Psychic Profile, The Real Deal, True Crime Cases, Volume Number 1. Robbie Thomas on Coast to Coast. Robbie, you do great work. I'm fascinated by it.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me, George.
Me too. It's so important doing what you're doing. There aren't a lot of people doing it at all. Did it take a while for law enforcement to get comfortable with you?
Yeah, it actually did. It took quite a while. I don't think it really caught on and became that phase until the early 2000s.
What was the very first episode that got law enforcement to start saying, hey, this guy may be the real deal, without probably thinking that you were a suspect because you knew so much?
Yeah, there was a producer that went missing on a show back in the early 2000s, and what transpired was they had a bolo out, be on the lookout, and there was a missing persons report out of Florida, Hamilton County. When I explained to them that he wasn't, they had some information, a tip, that he was shot dead in a hotel room, and they couldn't pinpoint this hotel, so they called me up and asked me various questions, and I said, no, he's not dead. I feel he's alive, and he's just really ticked. He's not in the same state. He'll call you in 3 days. They kind of chuckled at that, Well, sure enough, they wrote me a letter saying, you know, Robbie, you're an angel. He did call. It was 3 days later. He was alive. He was mad because they passed him up for promotion.
Did they start believing you right around then?
It caught on a little bit. It started to go a little bit further, and different cases got asked and if I could help, and people started phoning in to me and then tying me in with the detectives. And then it just slowly just progressed.
You sound like you're also a remote viewer, Robbie.
It does. It takes that type of avenue, if you will. There's cases where they've sent me photographs, and I'm sitting at home in Canada, and it'll be a case in Kentucky or, like, in Florida, another case of missing persons just recently. And within an hour, I hope that that one law enforcement officer who I did a double homicide with before, he's a repeat, I don't call him an offender, but he's a good law enforcement officer, and he's asked me to help him out in cases before. So within an hour, I did the remote viewing. We found her. She off the bus in Tampa Bay, and that's where they found her.
Wow. Now, do you help law enforcement in the United States as well, Robbie, or just primarily Canada?
No, this is actually law enforcement in the States. That was Kenneth City Police Department in Florida.
That case
came from. And also in Kentucky, and there's been Indiana, different places I've been.
What percent do you say would be Canadian cases versus U.S. cases?
It's a lot more American cases than it is
Canadian. Now.
Yeah, but although I do have a few that I've put into the book that are from my area in Ontario, Canada.
Okay. When this all started for you, were you a little kid, a youngster, when you started really getting these psychic abilities?
At age 2, used to... Back in the old days, when a woman had a baby out of wedlock, my mother met this gentleman, and he promised her the world and was going to marry her. She became pregnant, had a baby, and the Roman Catholic Church took the baby and put the baby up for adoption because they never got married. He went his way. So my mother was a single mother. Then years later, she met my father, married him, and had me. So you had this little boy running around age 2 and 3 saying, I feel like I'm adopted or I have somebody out there. And fast forward to 1994 now, my mother's funeral, her side of the family took me aside. It was her brother and her sister, and they said, all those years, you were saying that, and she's been looking for you, and her name's Mary. So I ended up meeting my steps, or my half-sister, and that was something else, and Fox did a special on it, and it was like a heartwarming story where, off a funeral, a gentleman meets his sister. So, yeah, it was...
After all these years?
After all those years.
Was it emotional for you?
It really was, because, you know, looking at when I met Mary, she was the spitting image of my mother. It was something else. All those years, I just knew, and it was inside me. And then finally, it came to fruition, and here she is.
And what augmented your abilities, Robbie? Because, you know, you got better and better and better at this. How did that happen?
When I grew into my adolescent years, my teenage years, and I knew my peer section, if they ever found out, I'd be crushed. And, you know, they would think odd of me or what have you. So I, in my first book I wrote back in 2003, I explained in depth of the teenage years. That was the hard part in growing up. My father bought a home. In the home, the gentleman died. There was a fire in the home, so we renovated that house all summer long. And it come to an August night, beautiful night, the moon's out, and the drapes were open in my bedroom. I shut the light off, I climb into bed, and I just look up, and there he is. There's a shadow person standing right there. I could see his hat, his overalls, the way he looked. He moved towards me. I screamed, and of course my mother came in, turned the light on, and he wasn't there anymore. So over the course of that summer, the remainder of that summer, I got to know this individual. And what was explained to me was the three people across the road were really good friends with him. It was Mr. Leach, Mr. Harding, and Mr. Waters. And Mr. Leach used to come over and sit on the front porch with my father and talk and, you know, talk a storm up all summer long and whatever. And I just remember that stout man. He was a very stout man. And he would come across the street holding his pants and sit there and talk. And I just stare at him. And he just thinned away. He had cancer. He ended up passing away. Mr. Harding had a heart attack. And then Mr. Waters died in a hunting accident. They were all best friends with the gentleman that was in the home. Well, that was all explained to me through this gentleman that these three were going to pass soon, and they did. So as a teenager, I was learning to cope with all these different types of messages that were coming in, how to configure my own thoughts on what was going on and how to perceive everything that was happening.
At that point, at that time, did people come to you for help and assistance?
Not at a teenage years, no.
Okay.
What went on is I went through to be a police officer the first time at age 17. And when I got hired, I got fired the same day.
What happened?
Well, you have to be 20, 21 to be in the
military.
Right?
Tricked them, huh?
Yeah. Well, I, you know, here I am. I look like I was 20, 22 years of age.
How did they realize you were so young all of a sudden after hiring you?
Yeah. Well, we went through the testing. And when I signed the papers, I was in Chief Cook's office, and he came in, and the other two auxiliaries were to my left, and he kept his eye on me, but he was in a very good mood.
He knew.
And he knew. And then he said, son, how old are you? And I told him, there was a big laugh, and yeah.
So you didn't lie to him?
No. And then he said, come back when you're older. But then I continued doing my police testing when I got older, and I got hired on a little town outside of Toronto, Canada. And after that episode, when I got back home, after going through all the final brass questions, all the psychological testing, I was back home, and a lady was screaming, accident. So I ran through the back door of my house, over the fence, and there she was in a robe. She was pointing down the lane. We have this town, row of townhomes. I thought a car accident, so I'm just running to go help, assist.
Sure.
I round the corner, and there's no cars. And then there's this gentleman to my left, he's going over here. So then I run into the sliding doors, and I get into the kitchen area, and there's a lady to my left running around screaming on a table. There's a gentleman to my right holding a doorknob to a door, and he says, come here. So I went over to him, and now I'm still thinking accident, because that's the main thing. People are screaming. And then when he opens the door, he grabs me, pushes me in. I'm looking at the floor for blood. And as he shuts the door, there's a gentleman in the bathroom, and he's staring at me. So I go over immediately to him. There's no blood. He's got purple blue lips. His eyes are wide open, and you can see inside and like he's not there. So immediately, CPR and the training of vitals, I check him. And then I go to do CPR, and I hear, let me go. And I stop for a second, and then I didn't hear that. So I went back, and I started doing the CPR. and I heard really loud, "Let me go." So that's when I stopped. I backed out of the room and found out later through the coroner, he had a massive tear in his heart. It was a coronary that he had. There's no way of saving him. Then I decided I'm not going to be a police officer anymore. I wanted to quit. So you just don't get hired and then quit. They want to find out why. So they sent a film crew and the captain, the sergeant from the Chatham Police Force, and they came down and they were filming a working tool for EMTs, firefighters, and police officers who quit under duress.
Huh.
I wasn't stressed. I just knew that I was going to go in a different
direction. Yeah.
Yes, right. So, got to the line of questioning, and the big question came, why are you quitting? And I told him, I said, I heard him. He said, let me go, and I just know I'm not going to do this. I'm going about it a different way. And their faces were blank. So, but that's my first movie I'm in. That was about 21.
Amazing. And then, well, how old were you when you started writing?
Oh, well, 2002, I started really digging into the first book. I had a forums back in the early mid-90s to the early 2000s. It was called Robbie Thomas Forums. And a lot of people would come there. We would talk about different things, about spirituality and different things like that, way before there was Twitter and MySpace and what have you. And then I decided to formulate the book and put it together on how the other side communicates with us and how they mingle with us and how we're soul connected. And that's the first book that came out. It was called A Link to Heaven.
Amazing. Yeah, great work you've done. Now, would you be called the psychic criminal profiler? Would that be an accurate title?
That title was actually given to me by a police officer. I was dubbed that, and I'm also dubbed the Rolodex now because they just call me up on the Rolodex.
And there you are.
You know, but yeah, that's how it was dubbed. It was dubbed psychic criminal profiler.
What would you say a psychic criminal profiler does?
What I do, I don't know what if there is or are other out there people out there who are doing. I know there are. But what I do is I take a case. I sit with the detectives. I listen to what they have to say. I draw my own feelings from that case. Then I do, we talked earlier, remote viewing.
And they take you seriously now.
They do. They take me seriously. Been down, worked with, and just come back from Washington. And there was the CIA agent's daughter was murdered in Maryland. So I worked with the DSA. The FBI just found the car in Virginia. They even brought an NSA guy on to scene. I spoke with him a bit. They don't talk much, but...
No, not at all. Especially in a case like this.
Yeah, so I was on my own, but I was around a lot of very heavyweights.
And what do they need from you when they meet
with you? They want a direction, a directive, something to give them that tangible piece. So when we went into the DSA's office, and after getting out of Ronald Reagan Airport, he showed me suspect one, suspect two, explained a little bit of what was going on. Then he handed me a map of all of Maryland, Virginia, and said, find her. That's all I was given. So we went back to the hotel room. I really didn't like the way the interview went. It wasn't because of the people in itself. It was the fact that it was the whole congestion of the case, the way that this girl has been treated and she was murdered and missing and everybody's all up in arms. So I get back to the hotel room. I'm a little upset. I grab the map. I'm staring at it. And I just circle a road right by Andrews Air Force Base. I throw the map down. My wife goes. I take my wife on all cases with me as well. She's my venting. I get to vent to her.
Okay.
And she goes, you're not done. I said, yeah, I'm done. She goes, that's all you're going to do? I said, that's it. So then the next morning rolled around. I went and seen Homer. They drove me back to see Homer, the detective. And I handed him the map. He looked at it, didn't say anything, said, get in the car. We drove in the car all over different parts of Maryland. He's going, is it here? And I said, nope. And he drove, is over here? And I said, no, it's not. I said, I know what you're doing, Homer. I said, let's just go back to that road I circled. He stops the car. We get out, and he goes, I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you do it.
They already found it there, didn't they?
Well, no, they didn't find her. What he goes, her phone pinged off the towers over by that area and then by Andrews Air Force Base. He goes, the one, the road that you circled in between, he goes, there's no way you could have known that. There's no way you would have known that at all. No one said anything. And he said, we're going to go back there. And I faxed him information before leaving Canada. And I said, it looks like the dumping ground. It looks like there's stuff dumped on this short road and it goes off to the highway. Well, if you got in the car, George, and you drove down there with us, it looked like an actual dumping ground all down that little road.
Like all kinds of things are tossed around out there?
Yes, beds, TV.
Okay, yeah.
Yep.
And was the car there?
The car was found in Virginia. It was washed, meaning it was bleached, by another individual. What they did was they brought the dog team out. The dog team did one pass, got a hit. It was just before winter, so the creek or the creek was full of water, and Homer started to dig. But every time he dug, the water would go into the hole. And
yeah, it just keep filling back.
Yeah, absolutely. So then what they did was they found a bag. Every item in the bag was what was missing or pertaining to her and him. So then we have a sweater, flip-flops, a chain. Tools are missing out of his truck. Tools were in the bag. Flip phones and a weapon. When they took the bag and the items, now this is a very, very different type of case as well, because Mom did not take the stand. She had the opportunity to take the stand to go and say her piece against the man who murdered her daughter. We can't find her body because she went pinged off the tower at the one county, and she went missing into another county. You can't arrest him murder without a body. That's just the way the law works there. So we're stuck in trying to find her.
Yeah, it's not a murder until they can find it, right?
That's right. That's right. So we've got a lot of stipulations here. It's very tough. It's agonizing. So we got the bag, and now they've washed their hands of trying to determine the DNA and everything that's on there and do an analyze of this bag, because Mom would not take the stand of being CIA against her daughter, because her daughter was, let's face it, she was a hooker. She was dealing heroin. She was with a man who in Maryland was very tied to drugs and what have you. So she didn't want to tarnish her reputation, so she didn't do that. They washed their hands of it. Yeah.
They let the killer go scot-free?
Well, he's not scot-free. Thank goodness for Homer, Detective Homer, who's
he went after
fired, and he's staying on this. They're submitted a paper with the Crown, and they're going to go after him in a different manner.
If this guy is listening to the show right now, Robbie, do you think he's panicking?
Oh, you know, when we drove by his house, Homer says to me, do you want to go and see where he lives? And I said, yeah, let's do this, because I've actually talked to murderers before. And so let's go do this. So we drove right by his house. There he was, washing his car.
No way!
You know he was...
Is he a family man?
What I don't understand, I'm in Canada, and if something like this happened in Canada, I think everybody would throw a fit. He's living in a house with a woman who has a daycare. Now,
has a daycare center?
There's a daycare center. He lives with a woman.
Oh, my God. And you think this guy's the killer?
Well, they know he's the killer. He has a record already. He's a felon. So I don't know how he can do it. I talked to Homer. He said, it's legal, but we got our eyes on him.
Unbelievable. What was the motive for the killing? Or was there one? There's got to be something, right?
Yeah, what we gathered is that he wanted to pimp her out again. She was trying to get her life together.
And she didn't want
that.
Unbelievable. All right, stay with us, Robbie. We're going to get into more of your psychic abilities and how this all works for you in just a moment here. Robbie Thomas, our special guest, his book, one of them, Psychic Profiler of the Real Deal. This is a truly psychic criminal profiler. And we'll be back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Robbie Thomas with us as we talk about his psychic abilities. Robbie, have you ever seen a crime being committed before it happens?
Yes. 2 days prior to a little girl going missing, I had a vision of this 8-year-old little blonde girl going into a tree line right beside a big pile of rocks and wood debris. I seen the horse and buggy wagon wheels, Mennonite drawn buggies, the laneway. I drew all this out, and as I did and kept my notes, I actually went and talked to a program director on another radio program in my home city.
Okay.
It was called Fox 99. And he says on a clip, he goes, I remember you showing me this before they investigated it. And he goes, I'm skeptic, but he goes, I'm a believer now. And then what I did was after it happened, and you know, George, there's nothing you can do. You can't stop the inevitable. I learned that over the years, no matter what happens, if you're shown the day before.
Really? You even if you tell the right people, they can't get in the way somehow?
That's the thing. I'm showing a portion or a part of what's going on. So if I would have known it was her name or where it was, maybe something different might have transpired, but at that time there was just, that's all it was given. So I just go with the flow. I do what I do. I've learned that over the years, you know, to make sure I make my notes, and I do it. 2 days later, she went missing, and sure enough, I get in contact with the family. I go down, I meet the family, and I get in, talk to Detective Brown. We're discussing matters. They got my sketches, they got what have you. Sure enough, little Victoria was found in the trees, in the tree line, beside a big pile of rocks. In the book itself, the amount of evidence that proves each case too, which I want the listeners to know, is all the text messages, all the emails, all the law enforcement testimonials are all there for each case, letters from families that stipulate what's all happened. So it just makes it very viable. Read to look at that and say, well, it truly does happen. And in saying that, you see the grandmother's one email. She says, it all came together, and I remember the Mennonite village or the people dressed in Amish clothing and the buggies and the wheels. And yeah, it's something that, again, I wish, George, there was something I could do to stop it. And all these years, I've not been able to. So I've learned you just can't stop the inevitable.
Why do you feel some crimes and some others you don't? Example, it would have been great had you felt this Florida situation before it happened and somebody would have listened. But like you say, it's inevitable. It can't be stopped. But what makes you pick up one episode and not 20 of them?
You know, I can't explain that. I wish I could. I just, it's the way that spirit moves or works. When I get called in on a case and they send me a photograph, and I'm looking at a four-year-old little boy from Kentucky, and I'm in my home. I'm just looking on the screen, and then I'm channeling everything that's going on. I get right down stadium lights, and I make the circles on the paper. And then they ask for more information. I get repeat offender of two boys. So I write that down, repeat offender, two boys. And then I write down flags that go in the ground for gas lines and men in orange vests and construction. Well, if he stood on the murderer's front porch, the construction was right in front of his house. And then the stadium lights, and I asked for a name. They give me John. So I put John. And if you look through the clearing of the tree line across the street, Papa John's Stadium was right there. So this is the information I'm getting, and I'm gathering it. And then when there was a pull away, that pull away was the boy being murdered, and I felt that. And there was nothing, it was a void. There was absolutely nothing. And in the book, I don't hold back on language. It's very raw. It's just how I am. And when I explain it, I talk about I'm angry because there's nothing. There was absolutely nothing left. And then all of a sudden, we channel back in. And as I'm getting channeled back in, I know that he's been murdered. So then I'm yelling it out loud. I said, give me his name. And he did. He gave me Cecil. And I write Cecil. And on the little descriptive little picture through a four-year-old boy's eyes was the monster. And if you take a look, that's in the book, the picture of the mugshot of the monster and him, it's very uncanny how the ears and everything are all the same, pointy and,
yeah.
You know. And then I just wrote that down, the name Cecil, and put an arrow to the monster's head, and all the demographic of who he was and what happened. That was the man who murdered the 4-year little boy, Cecil Eugene New.
Have you ever had a brain scan or anything like that done?
You know, years ago, I'm talking maybe 10, maybe 15 years ago, this scientist in England wanted to fly me over and he wanted to hook me up to things to do, scanning of my brain, and I'm just not going to be a guinea pig.
Well, I don't blame you. I don't blame you. Are you happy you have this gift?
No.
Is it like a plague to you?
Well, not so much a plague. It's that, you know, I've seen so much. I mean, I've actually with law enforcement, I look at autopsy photos. These are things that normal people shouldn't see. In the normality of life, this is not what you should see. You know, I see the death over and over, and then there's also the good stuff. I find people alive and I bring them home. But
and that's got to be rewarding for you.
Yes, yeah, that's rewarding. I mean, a mom who followed me since the mid-1990s, and she called me up one day and said, I just thought I'd never have to use you. And I said, what's the matter, Kim? And she said, her daughter got taken into the sex slave trade, and the detective his arms are up in the air, doesn't know what to do, so he asked if we can talk. And I said, sure, let's see what we can do. And I tried to describe what I seen and what I wanted her to do. And she said, there's no way I am going to do that. I come from a very conservative family, and they'll just disown me. So the heated discussion went on for a bit, and then we hung up the phone. It was the next day she called me back again, and she said, yeah, I'm going to do what you do. And I said, look, you have to do what I say, because you can't think and rely on what other people feel or say to you. You have a daughter that's missing, and they're not going to be able to go and find her. So I'm trying to tell you, you came to me, this is what we're going to do. I said, they're watching your social media. You have to put this on your social media. They're watching. Sure enough, George, they're watching her social media. Anyway, this was like a Friday.
You mean the people who took the daughter?
Yes, okay. Absolutely. And the daughter was watching it too. And when she put down what we discussed, I can't remember verbatim what we all discussed and put down there, but she put it down. The Friday that happened, the Sunday she had her daughter back. She wrote the letter. And in her letter, she writes, and he brought my daughter home.
Now, who'd she write the letter to?
To me.
To you.
She said,
you
can put this on your website, or you can put this in whatever I can use it for.
Did police come and ask for help, or just the lady?
Through her, the detective asked her to call me.
I mean, this sounds like a huge criminal enterprise that you could bust up.
Well, it's huge. Believe me, sex slave trade is huge.
Human trafficking, same thing, right?
Human trafficking, that's what it is.
It's been going on in this country for a long time. It's probably happening by the thousands of people, I would guess.
All over. I write in the book on social media. There's a chapter in the book, and I want all families out there to, if you can, you know, this book is a double fold. It's information for the families, for your children, for you. It's to show you, you know, social media. There are monsters out there on social media today, and they're watching. Believe me, they're watching. So there's a whole chapter about social media in there and your child and what precautions to take.
When you look at social media as a psychic, do you pick up anything, any feelings?
On certain people, absolutely. People who want to join in on, say, my different social media, I just don't let them in. There's a lot of criminal and content out there, a lot of bad people. There truly are.
I mean, here's some quotes of some people in your book. He brought my daughter home alive. I mean, that's uncanny. Or thank you from a police department in Florida for helping them find people. I mean, when you have these hits, do you know that you're right?
Yeah, it's more than a gut feeling. It's I used to describe it, it sticks to your ribs. But it's something that's really deep inside, and I just know. It's when I held the microphone underneath that one suspect's face, and the detective said to me, what are we going to do to get, I said, let's go after the weakest link. There was three of them. Let's go after the weakest link. Give me some Bristol board. I'll profile him, his character, what he did during the double homicide, and what he did after. So I did, and we're playing good cop, bad cop, and Bobby agreed to meet us at the end of his driveway. So we drive down there. Andy got tired of the ongoings of Bobby because Bobby was being sarcastic. and he kept calling me Mr. FBI man, which I didn't appreciate. So Andy pulls out the Bristol board, puts it on the hood of the SUV, and says to Bobby, read that. Bobby looked at it, and he just went pale. And then I held the mic there, and I said, I know you were there. I know you didn't do it, but I know you were there.
He was a witness.
He took part in it.
Okay.
He took part in it, but not the actual hurting or the cutting, but he was there.
And did he go state's evidence?
No, he confessed on tape. We got the tape, and in the letter of the law enforcement officer in that chapter, he explains how the old guard that was in there, they're all out now. They're not there anymore, but they were in that whole county, and there is a Hazard County, by the way. It's very close by, and there's a lot of methamphetamine labs and people on the take and, you know, crooked cops and stuff. And in any profession, and I work with police officers, and they'll tell you the first thing, any profession, there's people crooked, teachers, anything, anywhere.
Of course.
So, you know, it's just been a fact of life. And in saying that, we handed the tape over. We waited out in the lobby, and he called us in, and me and Andy were thinking, well, we got this, and we got a blank tape handed back to us, and Bobby went out the back door.
Hmm.
Yeah, strange.
Robbie, one of your books is called Signs from Heaven. When you're in this mode, do you get help from something on the other side?
Yeah.
Do you have angels, like a spirit guide or somebody?
Yeah, angels and guides. And I often speak to my mother's on the other side, so I often speak to her. I speak to people who have passed on in other family. If it's your family or someone, God forbid, and somebody else's family, I'll ask them to come along and help and give us some information, point us in the right direction.
And they jump in and help?
And they do. They do. So
you don't have a specific spirit guide, some angelic spirit or something?
No, no. It's whoever's going to help at that moment does. I find it's very, to be more open that way, I'm more apt to get more information. And in saying that, it's quick. Sometimes I question it, but then, you know, I look at it a second time and go, it's feasible. It's very feasible. And we look at it and we render our decision, and it is part of the case.
I would guess, you know, because of what you do, where you're full of all this crime and you see all this all the time, I mean, how do you sleep?
There's times very little, and that's the truth. I relive all these cases of these little kids, these beautiful little angels, over and over. I talk to my wife about them all the time. And as I speak to you and I say, I wish I could have stopped it. You know, there's no stopping it. And that's my vent, is my wife. And she's there. She's my pillar. I talk to her continuously about all these different crimes. You know, there's a major high-profile case right now where you are in L.A., and I'm working with LAPD on it.
Can you say what the case is?
Yeah, we can, because, you know what?
Without proper names or something?
Yeah. I'm just trying to think how we can get around this. The Biltmore Hotel held in America's Got Talent. Back in 2010, there was a woman from an individual who was going to be a contestant, and he's a rock star, but she was found at the bottom of the stairwell, half naked, murdered. So for about a year, maybe 2 years now, we're going on about 2 years now, talking with him and the detective. And I'm working with my partner, my new show that's coming out. It's Chief of Police Martha Decker from Texas. So we're going back and forth, and we're discussing all the aptitude of this case. It's amazing because I'm in Canada. They were trying to figure out how she fell down the stairwell without blood being on the walls, bouncing off the stairwells all the way down. And, you know, you have a lot of broken bones, but there wasn't. And then I read him, and I told him is the gentleman's, or the lady who died, the husband. I explained to him there's a backside to this hotel, and you go down this one area and you walk. I'm not going to give specifics. People have run down there.
She was married before, wasn't she?
She was married to him, and then 2 weeks later, he married somebody else.
That's bizarre.
Bizarre. Wait, you should see it. I got he reinvented, if you will, the way it all happened, and it was through the vision where I told him how it really truly happened. Go down the stairwell, go way down this area, there's no cameras. It's an old part of the hotel, and you go down this long corridor. Right there's the door. You open the door, that's the stairwell. That's where her body
is. So to date, nobody's been charged with this?
No, we're very close. We're very, very close.
Huh.
Yeah, they just brought in 3D imaging. They're spending millions of dollars on this, by the way.
Yeah, that was, about a 5 or 6 year old murder, something like that?
2010.
2010. So how long does it take for you to pick up signals and signs and feelings of an episode?
Quickly, very, very quickly.
Are there ever times you don't pick up anything?
Sometimes it takes a little bit to draft itself into me. Yes, true. There's times where I found people alive within an hour, missing endangered lady in Florida, and I get the call. The bolo went out at 9:30 in the morning, and it wouldn't hit the news. And I start speaking with the detective, and I'm giving him variables. And they had a few law enforcement out looking for her, and every time I'd tell him something or text him or talk to him on the phone, he would be sending his men certain areas. Then I started to give him more detailed information about taking a bus, the Bay Area, and what have you. Now they have hundreds of police officers out and a helicopter, and they found her at 10:30. So it was within an hour we found her in Tampa Bay. From Kansas City.
Gee, strange. Well, stay with us, Robbie. We're going to take a quick break and come back and take phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. And I remember that story of the man blaming the hotel for his wife's murder, basically, when they said that there was no sign of foul play. That was an amazing story. I'm glad you're on it. We'll come back with more.